Welcome to All Road 65 Max Radio, where the road ahead gets brighter as we journey towards truth, traveling through our dreams and an inspiration into a new reality. It's time, and your ticket is waiting. All Roads Lead 65 Max Radio with Pamela Henderson.
Greetings. Thank you for joining me on BBS Radio, All Roads 65 Max. I am your host, Pamela L. Henderson. My focus is my mission statement: to help create a quality of life through social growth, inspiring jewels to become leaders by establishing partnerships with entrepreneurs, corporations, donors, sponsors, volunteers, the community, and abroad. Please join me every other Tuesday at noon on BBS Radio, All Road 65 Max. And follow me at allroad65max.org. My special guest today is Mr. John J. D'Angelo, filmmaker, writer, and creative technologist, known for blending classic storytelling with cutting-edge visual innovation. His recent project, The Hook, a stylized indie action thriller starring Michael J. White, and I apologize for that, Michael J. White and Malin Ackerman, showcases passion for filmmaking and narrative-driven visuals. With over 30 years in the entertainment industry, D'Angelo began his career as a songwriter and performer, securing a publishing deal with Sony ATV before transitioning into directing music videos and short films and national campaigns for major lifestyle brands. His visual style is rooted in narrative clarity impact, a certified Unreal Engine filmmaker and Unity game designer. Mr. D'Angelo fuses decades of creative experience with emerging technology to craft stories that span film, advertising, and interactive media. His body of work reflects a commitment to elevated storytelling, technical innovation, and exploration. At last, I want to say thank you for giving me this interview chance, Mr. D'Angelo, and welcome to the show.
I'm happy to be here. Looking forward to this.
Thank you so much. And so where are you from?
Originally, I was born in Florida, and then spent the majority of my life in Central Florida, in Ocala, so horse country.
Then
moved to South Florida to pursue music, and then music led me to Los Angeles to pursue film, which was always the goal from when I was small. That's music, big part of my life, but film was always the goal. And then from Los Angeles, I ended up in Vegas, where I've put down roots and bought a home, have a family. And yeah, so that's where I'm at today.
Oh, okay. How's the weather out there in Vegas?
Well, right now it's cold and I'm loving it.
Yeah.
I wait all year for this. And it took like a rainstorm or a monsoon of some kind to bring it in. But I'm thankful. I live up in the mountain areas, like north of Vegas. We're always a few degrees cooler than the rest. But it's still hot. So I'm happy. Yeah. I'm happy that
I
it's
love
cool.
Vegas. I love
Vegas. Vegas is great.
Absolutely. Yes, sir. So tell me, what type of music did you create? What would you
say? So I was in an active rock band many years. It took multiple iterations, and to make money in between during those years, we did a lot of cover music. So I kind of started out in the female fronted rock band scene, and then that took a couple iterations, some different singers, and I was always songwriting behind the scenes and playing guitar. And then when those didn't kind of pan out, I just kind of took the bull by the horns and said, you know, hey, I can sing. So I started singing. And then many years of that led to a publishing deal, and I was with an absolute fantastic band called Ghost of Gloria, which led to that publishing deal. And then we toured, did a bunch of extensive touring, And then the publishing deal kind of brought me into studios on a writing level, and I worked with some great artists up in New York, in Nashville, California. And then when the film pursuit was no longer avoidable, and I had to make a move on it, I chose between New York, Nashville, and Los Angeles, and I chose Los Angeles, and that's how the music thing led me here.
Yeah, that was my next question because I have a bunch of questions. And my
Hit
next
me.
question was, when did you first realize you wanted to become a writer? Because you do so
Well,
many different things, and it was like, wow, but it all makes sense, all in the
storytelling is it, right? Storytelling is sort of the like I didn't like, even with music, I didn't enjoy a song unless I could enjoy it acoustic guitar by a fire. If the words and the story wasn't going somewhere, it didn't have some kind of a meaning, and that doesn't mean it has to be a deep meaning. Like, I'm okay with fun songs that don't really mean much, but they have to mean something, right? And for me, that's just my personal take. So all of my writing process, from when I didn't know what I was doing till now, when I think I kind of know what I'm doing, it's always about driving a narrative. And music obviously is a fantastic way of doing that, not only through lyrics, but through the emotional ride you take people on through composition. But film is the ultimate storytelling
it
story. It's just the ultimate medium for that. Yeah.
is. How do you ensure that your vision aligns with the script and the producer's expectations when you're creating?
I guess the right way to answer that is to nail down the scope of what the project is, right? If it's sort of an assignment piece, right, where you're working with a brand and they have a very specific need, a very specific optic that they're going for, you kind of have to just sort of fall in line with that, no matter how much you want something to be more creative or more have more of a particular thing that it's missing. If that thing that it's missing falls out of line with what the brand is asking for, or the producer is asking for, then you just simply can't do it, right? And you have to find a way to like enjoy the limitations that you find yourself in so that you can still make great art and you can still tell a great story. But it always has to fall in line with the direction that's being given. When you're fortunate enough to be the director as well, then that changes things. But generally speaking, from a writing standpoint, you kind of have to stay in your lane, if you're doing it professionally, until you're able to direct it as well, and then you can sort of have a little bit more control there.
Yeah, great. What are some of the most significant projects you have directed, and what impact did they have on your career, in your opinion?
Sure, I think in the commercial space, there was several, a lot of brand stuff, a lot of lifestyle stuff too. There was some campaigns that didn't ultimately get picked up, but that's kind of out of your hands. Like, you kind of get the job from a studio that's looking to get something produced or directed, and then you do your best, put your best foot forward there. And then sometimes the actual brand makes a decision to go a different direction. Other times you nail it. Really just kind of all depends. But I would say, there was a lifestyle brand, that ultimately closed up shop, but at the time it had a really good scope of what it was looking for. Very broad sort of campaign. It was a brand called Tat. It was a sort of a lifestyle non-nicotine based sort of cigarette brand that was trying to take off. But why that specific company's thing meant so much to me at the time was because the campaign was sort of like about multiple lifestyles that were using their brand. So you had a bartender that would smoke a cigarette, and then you would have a mechanic that would smoke a cigarette, and then you would have mul just multiple a hiker that would go out and enjoy nature. And it just had this full span of all these different lifestyles, and every one of them had their own little mini sort of movie, a little window that you could see into them creatively. So I feel like that one did a lot for me at the time for exploring like the different sort of the different faces that you could put on one particular brand. So that was great. This movie, The Hook, is obviously a very big moment in my career because I get to step out of doing commercial and corporate work and actually start to do the dream, the actual dream, the lifelong 35 years of dreaming dream. And that's not always a glamorous transition, right? Because sometimes I'm not making the movie that like I have 15 screenplays that I would love to make. And you know, this wasn't like my movie, right? This was a movie that was sort of like already kind of like going, and then it was like, hey, let's get in there and see how we can make this something that fits me as a creator. And the writers that were already on the movie were just unbelievable people. Chad Law is a fantastic writer. He's written tons of movies that we've all seen, and I would work again with him in a heartbeat. But it was very much an assignment piece when it came to writing. But the process of it was obviously something I'm going to remember forever. It was my introduction into finally directing feature films, and it's going to be a long career from here. That's the goal.
Yeah, it sounds like it. It sounds like it. I was on your website and I was reading about your journey. And it was like so enlightening. And also, I know that I want to discuss about the game design. And it's what was it called? Run.
Oh, the Rune Lords. Yeah, the Rune Lords.
The Rune Lords, yes.
Yes.
Game. And I was looking at that and I was like, oh my God, it seems so creative. So tell me a little bit about that. And is it like in between like a Monopoly or what is the game really like? Because
Yeah.
I am
No,
very
it's
interested.
interesting. No, it's great that you bring up Monopoly because honestly, Monopoly, Chutes and Ladders, these kinds of things. Also, Cards versus Humanity. All these kinds of like core board game experience that people are used to experiencing. Like that's the family board games, and most people see board games as that. If you're not into the hobby, right?
Right.
But the second you step into the board gaming hobby, I'm telling you, it's a whole universe.
Right.
People are not ready for it until they see it. That game specifically is a very elite sort of nose in the air, not gonna lie. It's like a Warhammer sort of tabletop experience where you have miniatures that go onto this battlefield that's painted on a nice board in front of you. And then
Right.
it's sort of like cards are driving, you're drawing from a deck of cards that are giving your characters like abilities that can turn. It's a very sort of video game, but in real life experience, right? And while it's unique in its own way, there's nothing overly unique about that concept. It might seem so to somebody that maybe isn't used to that particular genre of media,
Amy,
but once you get into that space, there are a lot of games like that. Warhammer is the pinnacle of it. But it has like a Dungeons and Dragons flair to it. It's got a lot of those things. How I got into it, my entertainment attorney is also the entertainment attorney for the author of a book series called The Rune Lords. David Farlan is the author. And
Okay.
he just knew my creative passion for wanting to get into this space. And I told him that I had a really great game system that I was designing with a very close friend of mine named Sean Engel. And we wanted to apply an IP to it. And my attorney just said, hey, I think you might have something here. I don't know if he'll say yes, but here's his information. Go for it. And then I spent the next 3.5 years creating the most wonderful relationship with a legendary fantasy author who we unfortunately lost him a few years back to a sudden accident, but he left behind a legacy of tremendous grandeur. His Rune Lord series has been around since I was in high school. I was very familiar with it. And it's like like a Witcher, or it's like a Wheel of Time. Like it's at that level of respect
Right.
within the fantasy genre. And I sort of skinned this gaming experience using his IP. And then we kind of developed the game from there. And that's sort of like that's why it might have that fantastical flair that you see on the website. You saw
Yeah.
that.
Okay, and how is it doing? So you're selling it and everything now on your website and
Yeah, so how this is an interesting thing too about that culture, the board game culture. The board game culture is driven two ways. You can make a game and then just put it on the shelf, go, just publish it yourself. Or you can go to Kickstarter or GameFound or some of these fundraising sites. And that is really the heart of the board gaming experience because most people can't afford to make games that have these very expensive miniatures and metal pieces and fancy dice. It's a very expensive production. So the fundraising, crowdfunding community sort of embraced board games many, many years ago. And that's like a primary way that these games are made. Unfortunately for us, we decided to launch this game and it our second campaign, but the campaign that was trending to get funded started 2 or 1 week before China shut down for the for COVID. And that just all communications with China went down, which is where we were getting it manufactured. A lot of people weren't sure if they wanted to spend money on things like games at that time. So we put a pin in it. It is a fully fleshed out, ready to go game, but our production company started moving forward with other revenue generating sort of projects. But that is absolutely a turnkey situation that will be getting released. We're hoping in probably Q3 of next year. So that's the goal.
That's the goal. Great goal. That is a great goal. I love it.
It's
I
a great goal.
love
We got to do it. It's
it.
done. It's we have years of work. To say years of work into that game is an understatement. Like the amount of art, sculptures, design. We went to 18 gaming conventions across the world. Like it was like a very that game brought us to Germany. It brought us to London. It brought us like all over the world. So it was a huge, huge chapter in our life, and we absolutely will get it. We absolutely will get it released.
Yeah, it's like you and you know, it's important that we do that when we're branding because we get in where we fit in, right? So true. That is so true. And speaking about that, I want to go back a little bit because I was interested, as I stated, reading about you and everything. And I am award-winning author of my book, my first book. It's called Journey of a Sapphire. And I would really like to see my book in a documentary or the story about my journey, because I know I can, my story will help a lot of people. And I'm speaking about not just going through challenges and obstacles, but faced with death. So tell me, what is it that I really need to do, and how do I move forward of reaching out to someone or connecting with someone for regarding a documentary? Or what is
No,
your
sure.
suggestions?
No, absolutely. This is an incredibly good question, and it applies to everybody that has a dream or a passion or something. You seem like you've already done a lot of the legwork, especially if it's already received awards or whatever. So when I say this, you might be in the higher percentile of success for something like this, but it's still a general concept that I think everybody needs to sort of embrace.
Okay.
I think it really is about finding a production company that you believe you work well with, somebody that
Okay.
you think would do well with your book, reach out to them and unselfishly offer your assistance and your value to them for whatever they have going on. Because even if they love your stuff, they're going to have slates of stuff in front of whatever it is that even if they wanted to make your stuff, there's a very good chance that they're going to have to wait until these productions get finished before they could move on to yours. Anyway, right? So in that time, what better way to make sure that production goes into effect and doesn't get canceled, doesn't get sidebarred, is in that time frame while you're waiting anyway, be helpful. And that sometimes doesn't mean it means helping without getting paid. Other times it means helping getting paid for little. It could be if, let's say, with me, for example, I'm very good with 2D media. So that's something that I could offer. I could do movie posters. I could do storyboard drawings for people. I can do pitch decks for companies that are looking to get something made. Another thing is that I'm very savvy with AI. So, and I stay on top of AI all the time. So if somebody needs a small AI campaign generated, that's another way that I could help. I have my own camera equipment and my own sound equipment. If someone needed a small proof of concept or a commercial shot or a podcast set built, right, with lights and all that kind of stuff, there's a lot of ways that I could help give value to a company that is going to be appreciated. And then also, when the time comes to get that thing that I need made, they know that it's not all about me because it was about them for a long time. And then they see all the things that I'm good at and they go, well, of course, this guy can handle this movie, like when the time comes. So I think that's the secret sauce that a lot of YouTube channels and I think a lot of people out there that are doom and gloom, they say that the industry's over, that you can't make money, that it's impossible to get your stuff made. Well, if you're leading with make my stuff and you're not giving the person that's going to make your stuff any value, then it is going to be very difficult.
Right, I do
And
agree.
in that process, and I will say the final thing, so let's say it took 6 months between the time that you introduced yourself and said, hey, I've got a project, but how can I help you? That 6 months is going to go by. They're always going to know you want to make your stuff because in small talk, they're going to ask you about it. You're going to tell them about it. You're never going to lose passion about it. It's never going to be a mystery, right?
Right.
But over that 6 months, you've done so many things and you've had so many moments now where they've shared their passion for stuff. You're going to create friends, like legitimate friendships. And
Right.
then they're going to want to see you succeed when it comes time for your stuff. And I think that's the sauce. That's the missing. You're not going to walk into a room where a director that's done big movies is on a panel. And you're gonna run up to them in a hallway and say, like, here's my movie.
Right, right.
It's nothing to do with any other reason. It's just not how life works. It's not about how this works. It's about how life works, you
Right.
know? So I think that's it. I think that's how you would do that. Just give your value to a company and then let them make the decision when the time comes organically.
Okay. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. So, following that question, how do you adapt your vision to fit the budget constraints? So here I am coming to you. I got my book. I got this great idea. And I am the type of person, I do like to be involved no matter what, because I want it to come out, mwah, right? So tell me, what, in your opinion, what type of budget do you really need? You know, because you hear all this, you need this really, really, really big budget, or can you start off with something that, you know, kind of like can get you going where you can, you know, create something big, even though it may be something small?
Yeah, so budgeting is an interesting thing because if you don't think about the resources that you have and you only think about the resources that you want, right?
Right.
Then the budget is going to be X because you're going to make a list of the things that you want and that's going to have X cost. And sometimes you can pull a favor, right? Let's like what if you had a buddy. Like my family, there's a jiu-jitsu school in my family, for example, right? It's literally ingrained into the culture of my family. When I'm writing a character, if they need to have a hobby, why would I do t-ball? Like if I want, right? I have a jiu-jitsu school in my family. It seems like the right play there if I'm trying to make this happen on resources that I have, that the character in the movie is now going to be a jiu-jitsu player instead of a basketball player, right? I think that's kind of like a smart move, okay? But sometimes it's immovable. Sometimes it's a bank teller. The movie is about a bank heist. There's no way around it. Most people don't have friends that own banks, right? So this is going to be, you're going to hit some things that are immovable, right? It's a monster movie. You got to see the monster. Is it going to be CG? Is it going to be practicals? Is it going to be both? So sometimes there are going to be insurmountable things that are going to take resources that cost. Why? Okay, so now you're creating this. But the art of making a budget shouldn't be based off of only one thing, and that is your vision, and it's non-compromised. Because an uncompromised vision is a very, very, very tall order for even the most elite. Like Michael Bay would have trouble getting a film made that had every single inch of what he wanted on that screen. Like, it's just, maybe Grand Theft Auto 6 is going to pull it off, right? Because they have $1.7 billion or whatever it is that's been pumped into it, and they've had 9 years or whatever it's been, 12
Right.
years, who knows how long it's been. So maybe they're going to be the first piece of media that is ever exactly what they wanted. But even then, they keep pushing it back. It's like, and now it's like November, it's going to come out. So with infinite money and infinite time, you still need more time and more money. So if that's the way it's going to be, that applies even when it's like micro, even when you're making a very small production. So I think that's a long way of saying to budget your production, you really have to choose the wins and the losses. Pick your battles when you're budgeting. Pull resources and favors where you can. Don't abuse those relationships because you might need them again later.
Right.
And then, and consult professionals, and listen when they say that that's a roadblock you don't want to fight. That's a hill you don't want to climb. Listen to them on that. Don't climb that hill.
Don't climb that hill.
So I think that's a that's sort of the best way I could describe the process for somebody that doesn't already have a team that puts budgets together.
And how long does it take? So here I'm going to do my documentary. How long does it take? Does it is it 6 months? Is it a year? When I
To
can
make
expect
it or to budget it?
to make it?
To make it. Okay, yeah. So I'll give you an example. For the my next film that I have made, that I'm doing. This film, I knew I wanted it to be redlined and budgeted properly. So I went to a professional line producer, and I went to somebody that's done big movies, and I paid them their fee. They took a month to redline my script. They read it, they broke down the schedule, they broke down every prop, every action, every move. They broke out everything, right? As you should. And the reason I didn't do that myself is because I'm going to do it myself after anyway. But I'd much rather do it built on, based off of that, than based off of nothing. So now I
Right.
have this incredibly high level. This is this guy who's done a ton of movies, worked with the best directors and producers that I can think of, paid him his fees, and then got this. Now, that took a month. Okay. So that's 1 month down. Now I take that and I package it and I start taking meetings. Okay. I need to attach talent. You're talking about a documentary. So you don't have to get a famous person attached to it unless it's a sports documentary. And then it would be nice to have a famous athlete, right? Something like
I
that.
still want a famous person.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. Yeah. Or if you're going to get it narrated, right? So maybe the narrator is, somebody famous, right?
Right.
So if you do something like that, now you're taking meetings to get talent. And let's say Morgan Freeman does want to narrate it. Okay, great. So now you got Morgan Freeman, he's narrating your thing. You've got it redlined by a very, very predominant person that so you know your budget's accurate. You know when you send it off, you're not embarrassed. People could look at it and disagree, but there's not any conversations about what am I looking at here, right? Your top sheet is money. So you send it off. Now you've got talent attached. Now you're about 3 months in. Okay. So now you're really cooking. Now you got something that people can start figuring out. So now it's like, okay, where's distribution going? You start having that conversation. Is this going to be distributed yourself? Are you going to go with an aggregator that's just going to, charge you money? And then no matter how this thing comes out, it's going to live on Tubi. It's going to live on Amazon Prime. It's going to have somewhere, right?
Right.
But it's
Right.
not going to have a marketing campaign behind it. It's not going to be a Tubi exclusive or a Amazon Prime exclusive. It's going to be just what an aggregator does. It's going to get you a place to live. But if you want to do a proper distribution that's going to have a release date, maybe a theatrical, I don't know. I don't know what it's going to entail. So now you need to start having those conversations early, like where's distribution going? And then if you're going to produce it yourself. If you're going to produce it yourself, then you can invest in some equipment. Right now, with the Blackmagic ecosystem, you could do a documentary that rivals the best documentary ever made, and you could do it for under $20,000 in equipment. And that's easily under $20,000 in equipment if you have the right person shooting it. You just
Right.
get some great audio equipment, multiple packs, a nice three light setup for interviews. Put yourself travel budget for people so that you can go to their town, make it comfortable for them, and then send your DP and a director with the right questions, and Rinse and repeat.
happen.
Get all your stuff done, right? And then when you want to do B-roll and things like that, schedule 2 weeks to go out and get, nature shots if it's about nature, get city shots if it's about city. And then and I feel like you're well under $50,000 to make a really, really engaging, powerful documentary that has a known name, that's budgeted well. And I think that's kind of the
Yeah,
path. And then that
right.
all takes 6 months. Then you go
Six
into
months.
post. How much of a perfectionist are you? 6 months, 6 more months?
Well, that's a
Right?
whole
Like,
other story.
yeah, exactly. This is like a whole thing. Are you just throwing slapping LUTs on it and like, are
Right.
you really
He said, no,
coloring?
that's
Like,
a whole other
where are you
story.
at?
I know I'm a perfectionist. I know I am.
Yeah,
Everything I
sure.
do, yes. It has to be right. And sometimes I'm a little too much, and I have to, someone always telling me, okay, Pamela, it's good. Can we just like move forward? So, yeah, but that's
So a
good.
year. So a year, right? Like after that's I'm explaining why instead of just giving you an answer of a year. I mean, this is why. It could be a year.
Yeah, it could be a year. Okay. How do you stay up to date with new technology and techniques when you are creating? And the same thing with the game, everything changes, right? And also, I know I'm going a little bit further, but speaking of AI, so on my website, I'm having our new websites coming out, and we're going to be doing this launching and things like that. And we got the AI, of course, but I'm a little concerned about AI. Let me tell you why. Because I help teach and build customer service skills. And I know, like, if I purchase something, no matter if it's in person or especially online, and I may have questions. Now, I know AI is set up to address some of these questions that a consumer may have, but I want to really talk to somebody sometimes. How do you feel about that?
AI in general, I feel like I think the outlook on it is a little aggressive. I don't know that it's gonna, in any industry, that industry, the film industry directly, I don't know on a creative, certainly on a creative standpoint. I don't know that AI is ever going to be more than a tool to create a story in the creative space. And that could be visually. That could be through, okay. Where AI is not being understated, where I don't think it's too aggressive or bullish is when we're talking about like task-oriented jobs, right? That's going to go through the roof. Like there's like are we really going to have like what's the person in the courtroom that types the stenographer or whatever?
Yes.
How long is that job going to be? Like it's already technically gone. Like there's
Really?
no, you can just put a micro, technically, you can just put a microphone in a courtroom, right? And you
Right.
can just run
Okay.
AI and it could do shorthand, it could do whatever it is, and it's still all done in real time. And but minutes after the courtroom session's done, you have everything like organized perfectly in a sheet. It's like crazy. So technically, there are some jobs that I feel like are already replaceable by AI. But for us in the creative space, I just live it too much, right? Like if we're looking at filmmaking as an example, if you go to 99 out of 100 YouTube videos that are reviewing AI about filmmaking, they're talking about how close we are to having Hollywood level films made with AI, right? That's the conversation that is happening. What they're
Right.
not talking about, though, is they're not talking about how far we are from having outputs that are quality enough to even be released. If you watch the footage on your phone or maybe on your laptop, sure, we're in the neighborhood. But if we're talking about 8K or 4K outputs that are indiscernible from real life, that don't have artifacts on the screen, we're really far from that. Almost zero outputs that I've seen will pass QC when you try and get a movie put in a movie theater. It's just when you blow it up, it's too distorted. And when you up-res it through Topaz There's all sorts of problems that reveal themselves when you do, when you try and push it around in post or change its color or match the rest of the film. The blacks are in trouble. There's a lot of like artifacts and squares and electric blacks that are happening. So, yeah, I mean, I am confident that AI is going to be great for us creatives in the future, but I don't feel like we're quite there to have like concerns quite yet.
I know I'm going to get back to some of the same, a little bit of the same questions that I asked before, because again, I'm asking you this because I'm making sure when I come out with my little documentary, I am well educated, right? What role does research play in your filmmaking process when you're creating? Uh-oh. Can't hear you.
Can you hear me?
Oh, now I can.
Oh yeah, I couldn't hear. Yeah, I lost you for a second too. Yeah, you said what role does what play?
What role does research play
Research.
in your filmmaking process?
Ah, yeah. From the writing standpoint, you want to be accurate.
Yes.
So the writing, I think that's if the movie is about something specific, you definitely want to make sure your research is on point. You don't want to have a cop watch your movie and just be like, that's ridiculous. Nobody would handcuff somebody like that. It's like, yeah, 'cause that's what all the reviews are going to be about. It's just that like you did the handcuffs wrong, right? So you want to make sure you do your research when it comes to like technical issues. But I also think you owe it to yourself to do research on tone and mood and make sure that you're entering the conversation of a genre correctly, because there's a certain level of like sort of like wink wink amongst a genre's fans. Like we all kind of have like an unspoken rules that thrillers need to have a thing, and horrors, especially slasher movies, right? They have to have a specific like genetic code to them. And if you kind of go in and you veer off too far from a genre's like core, I think it's not going to be received well. Right, unless you're trying to do that specifically, like if you're doing like a scary movie, which is like a spoof where it's literally a comedy but it's based off of horror movies, well then it's really a comedy, so lean into the comedy tropes and then let the theme be the theme, but you want to make sure that your comedy stuff is on point if that's what you're making, right? So research the genre and that kind of stuff. So I think those things impact my work a lot. I want to make sure that I'm articulating properly. But aside from that, like you got to know when to bail from the research too, right? Unless you're doing a biopic or just you're doing something where it's like has to be exactly right.
You're right.
Know where to draw the line and let your creative take over, right?
Right. Just like when you're writing a book, same
That's
thing.
right.
That's right. How do you handle pressure while maintaining your creative vision effectively, communicating with your team? And you're always going to have, let me see, what we call in the stores, a Roxanne, or the Miss Privilege. And here you got to work with everyone. How do you handle that?
Yeah, I think working with a team is the best part of what I do. I even in music, I feel like I excelled in music because I was always comfortable being the worst musician in the room. That's where I was happiest. That doesn't mean that I didn't pursue being the best musician that I could be. Working with a team is arguably the best part of what I do. So when you are working with a team, and you're trying to get one singular vision accomplished, I think leading the team and being the North Star is part of the responsibility, right? The other part of the responsibility is allowing them to be good at what they're good at, because that's why they're there. That's literally why they're there. Sometimes you don't get to necessarily choose who they are, they're assigned to you, but that doesn't change the fact that you still need to stay, as an open source for them to sort of emit what's great about them, even if you didn't hire them, right? Like, if you're, for example, if there's an actor and the production or the studio says, this is who you're working with, sure, you're going to direct them and you're going to oversee them and you're going to try and get a little bit out of better performance out of them or whatever might be the case to fit your movie. But you still, at the end of the day, you still have to give them the room to be whatever it is that got them the gig.
Right.
And I think that to me, that's part of the fun. And with music, I was always comfortable with being the worst musician in the room. That was always something I was comfortable with. And that doesn't mean that I didn't apply myself to being a great musician. I always wanted to be a great musician, and I always became better and tried to become better. But when you're the worst musician in the room, like, that's when you can really see it. That's when you know, like, okay, like, it's guitar solo time, right? I could play a guitar solo. Sure, what key are we in? Let's go. But
Right.
that guy over there has spent every second of his life doing nothing but playing guitar solos. He doesn't write music. He doesn't write lyrics. He doesn't play 15 different instruments. He doesn't. Literally, all that guy does over there is play guitar solos. So
Okay.
when he plays one, come on, he's going to make mine look like I've never played a guitar solo.
Right,
The same thing
right.
goes for an art department in a movie. Somebody that is across wardrobe, they've seen 400 types of shoes and boots and tactical wardrobe. The two that I have in my head, what am I going to fight for those two? Like, no
Right.
way. I'm going to say they're like Timberlands, but I want them to have like a buckle. Like,
Right,
that's
right.
as far as I can take it, right?
Okay.
Meanwhile, you tell that to somebody that's done 15 movies and they're amazing at their job, they're going to give you 20 Timberlands with different buckles, and you're going to go like, oh, now my movie's coming together. That
Right.
boot, and you choose that one, right? So you need to learn, like, to guide the team, but at the same time, you got to step back and not be overbearing and allow them to sort of be the great artists that they are. And I think that's a fantastic part of the job.
Yeah, great advice. Thank you so much. What strategies do you use to keep the cast and crew focused and productive? Now, I know you spoke a little bit just now. However, there are still things as when we are creating and directing that we still may have to do. Tell me a little bit more.
I feel like that all starts with your demeanor. I think if you show up, no matter how stressed you are, tired you are, or no matter how cold it is or hot it is, like, if people get near you and they feel like you're making a movie, they're gonna feel like they're making a movie. And I feel like this applies to any job. If you're in the leadership position and the people get in your orbit and they feel like a positive, we're lucky to be here vibe, because you feel lucky to be there, then I feel like everything kind of falls in line. And that's the start of it, because the cast feels it, the crew feels it. So I think that's sort of a great step one. It's just keeping your mentality and your aura in check, because that will spiral very quickly. You get upset and everyone feels that you're upset, they're gonna, not only is it gonna put them in a bad mood, but 45 minutes or 3 days down the road, when they're upset, they're gonna feel like they have the freedom to feel the same way, to be upset.
True.
And that, and then that's gonna spiral, and there's gonna be little arguments here and there, and then you're gonna have to be putting out fires emotionally. I think everybody being on the same page in that way is, that's huge.
Same as you do with anything else that we do in a company, correct? Just wanted to make sure. Because when I, get this documentary out, I want to make sure that, everything is true. And I am a true believer that the way that the leader itself presents themselves is the way the day is going to go. So I thank you for sharing that because that is very, very important. And I go through that right now. It's bad enough that I have to take in everyone else's issues. But me, it doesn't matter. If I had a, bad day the day before, if something just triggered me in the morning, I know how to go in my little, I call it the secret room. And I just go in there and I may yell a little bit, get it on out, act all out and everything. But I come out like nothing ever happened. Okay, we fixed their thing.
I know that feeling. I've
I
acted out many scenarios in my head many, many, many times. Yeah. You try and get ahead of it. You're like, okay, let me just get through this, shake it off, get back to work.
absolutely, absolutely. So I know we spoke about this, but I'm going to ask you again. So I'm creating, I want to present my book to become a documentary. And I'm asking you because I'm looking at you and I may want to hire you. I think you'd be good for me. What technical skills do you possess that are essential for a film as a film director for my documentary?
Well, I would say making sure they're a documentary director. That's a very important, very,
Okay.
very important distinction because there are a lot of narrative film directors that could probably make a fantastic documentary. They probably could, right? And maybe they will at one point because they just need to scratch that itch.
Right.
Other documentary directors maybe could find it in them to make a great narrative film as well, although I do feel like it probably lends better going from the narrative to documentary than it does going from documentary to narrative.
Narrative. Okay.
But because there's just techniques involved that, like, you kind of have, there's no way around it. You have to understand the process of shooting dialogues and coverage. You have to understand coverage more when you're shooting a narrative than you do in documentary. But when you shoot a documentary, you could actually make a fantastic documentary using that coverage. It doesn't really go the other way too well. I mean, I could be a little bit wrong there, but I think I'm right. But with documentaries, though, it's really hard to stay hyper focused on one particular topic. Like, there is no, like, you have one goal, and that is to tell a very specific message by the end of the documentary. That's what you're documenting, right?
Right.
So you have to be hyper vigilant on making sure that everything that you're, every storyline and thread and interview and piece of footage is all like aiming towards one goal, right?
Right.
There isn't really a B story in a documentary unless you are clever enough to find a way in, right?
Right.
It's just one primary story.
Okay.
And that can be tough for some directors. So you got to make sure that the director is happy with that. Also, there's nothing really glamorous about interviews when it comes to cinematic. You can light it really cool. You can bring in your, you could be creative with it. You can show the lights and the cameras and the microphones just to be clever with it and make it look behind the scene-ish, or you can light it like a movie or whatever. But at the end of the day, you need to make sure that it's not distracting from what the person's saying. So you've already got kind of like a limit. You got like a ceiling, right? And I think that's another thing you got to make sure that whoever you hire is okay with, is that they're making sure that they're like, they're there for the documentary. They're not there for to try and vicariously use your documentary to make a feature film that they want to
Okay,
make.
okay.
Don't
Absolutely.
use your documentary as a way of expressing their desires to make a feature film. Like, make sure every decision they make is for your project. And
Okay.
it's not self-serving in the wrong ways. In the wrong ways. You do
Great.
want them to be self-serving, right? You want them to love what they're doing, but you
Right.
want to make sure that they're doing it for the right reasons. Yeah.
And they have to read the book first, right?
They better.
Okay, yeah, they have to read the book
They
first.
better read the book first. Yeah, they should want to.
Okay. And that is true because I got the wrong advice because someone told me that they don't necessarily have to read the whole book. But to me, I think you have to read the whole book because how are you going to know what the ending of the message is and what am I stating to the world? So I'm glad I have you. So thank you so much. What advice would you give aspiring filmmakers who want to go into filmmaking?
I think this we did allude to this a little bit earlier, but I think it's a really important message. In fact, like to the day I retire, I'm any chance that I get an opportunity to squeeze this message in, I'm gonna say it until I'm blue in the face, because my dream, I feel like I could have accomplished my dreams faster had I had my outlook on things been a little bit different. And so I'll say this. The first thing is, don't live in an echo chamber full of ne negativity. Meaning, if you need 50 reasons to not make a movie, or you need 50 reasons as to why the camera you own isn't good enough to shoot a movie, you can find it. You can find 100 reasons, infinite reasons. And if you want to, you could go online and you could find, like, for example, I owned a Blackmagic Pocket Cinema camera for many, many years. Really popular camera amongst the like entry-level filmmakers and content creators. Cool. But the second you start talking about RED cameras and Arri cameras and Sony Venices, and you start getting into all these conversations that you go to NAB and you walk around the convention and you see all these $55,000 camera bodies with nothing else attached to it. You start thinking about your Blackmagic at home and you go like, well, I guess I can't make a movie until I get here. Now you've moved your goalpost. And you did it to yourself, right? Like that person on that YouTube channel that told you your Blackmagic camera is not good enough to shoot a movie. He's a real person in real life, yes. And if you ever met the person, treat him accordingly or her accordingly, sure. But until then, they're two-dimensional. They're just a screen. They're not real, meaning they're not tangible reasons to be changing the course of your own life based off of what they're saying. They shouldn't have that much weight. And I feel like, because if you wanted to, you could just as easily go into Google or into YouTube and say, what feature film has been shot on a Blackmagic camera? And guess what? You'll find hundreds of feature films shot on a Blackmagic camera. Now that's a whole different message than you were just being given by Mr. Negative over here, right? So maybe that's where you should be focusing your energy. Look at people, look for reasons to do something. Don't look for reasons not to, because there's plenty of reasons not to do stuff, right? So surround yourself in an echo chamber of positivity. Let that be what hits your algorithm. Reasons to move, reasons to be motivated. And I don't mean like David Goggins, like get out of bed and do 700 push-ups, extreme stuff. I mean subtle things like brand new cinema lenses that cost $99. That's a great thing to hit my algorithm, right? Because now I'm being fed achievable goals. I can buy a $100 lens. As much as I want to work on an Arri Signature Prime, like I don't want that hitting my feet every day if I'm not there yet. That's going to just move the goalpost every time I see it. Things are going to feel impossible. And I think that's the message that I feel like any budding filmmaker needs to understand, is that like you need to be positive. And the second thing, arguably the most important, is what I mentioned to you about getting your movie off the ground, is be useful, be helpful. You have to surround yourself around people that are making movies, but you can't get into their orbit. You can't break into their circle unless you have value. That doesn't mean that they're going to use and abuse you, or that they wouldn't be nice to you if they met you at a bar or whatever. They're humans. But if you're going to be valuable for them professionally, you've got to prove it. And it's like everyone talks about you're going to have to run coffee until you make movies. What about in between running coffee? Like, it doesn't jump from running coffee to making movies. Like, there's this huge space in between that. Being an intern doesn't mean only answering emails and serving coffee. Being an intern could also mean designing movie posters. It could be showing up to hold the cables for the sound guy. It could mean like jumping on the grip truck at 4 o'clock in the morning and just waiting for an opportunity to get your hands on a flag and move the flag when somebody needs it and help the DP out. So like, and being useful and being valuable and not surrounding yourself with negativity, that leads to success. Those two things.
Absolutely. You couldn't have said it any better. Thank you so much. Well, readers, you heard it. Yours truly, John J. D'Angelo. So tell us before we go, how can someone reach you or contact you about your services or follow you on social media? And
Sure.
especially about that game that's going to be coming out, because that's going
Oh,
to
for
be.
sure. Yeah. So on Instagram, you could find my Instagram handle, John underscore J underscore D'Angelo. And then there's obviously IMDb for the feature film and that kind of stuff. You could go to my website, redginpro.com, for commercial work. If I still shoot music videos and I still shoot ad campaigns and commercials and corporate work as well. And even if I personally don't show up to do it, I have a team of people we can facilitate to make that happen. So that's another way to reach me. And then, yeah, just following all the handles for the Hook movie, the Hook movie. We could chop it up on social media. We could chop it up through email. Like, open book.
Okay, thank you so much. Well, readers, I have reached my destination. As always, I leave you with this quote. Great men are not born great. They grow great. Thank you so much. Until next time, do have a beautiful day. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to All Roads 65 Max Radio with Pamela Henderson. Join us every other week on Tuesdays, 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on BBS Radio Station 1. And please visit allroads65max.org and become a volunteer or a sponsor and be the change you want to see in this world. With your help, we can make a difference in our society and uplift those who so desperately need our help. Thank you for tuning in.